This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kooser. Today we'll be talking about the unique structure of local government in Connecticut and how closely residents pay attention to it. Do you know who sits on your town council? How much money is in your town budget? Why do we have a mill rate? Why aren't there county governments in Connecticut? If you don't know the answers, you're not alone. Many residents of the state don't have a clear understanding of how their local governments work, why it works the way it does, or even who runs it. Political science professor Gary Rose knows there's a critical knowledge gap in this respect, and he's written a slim volume that offers a comprehensive overview of the unique structure of Connecticut's local governments. Professor Rose is the chair of the Department of Government, Politics, and Global Studies at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. His new book is called New England Local Governments, The Case of Connecticut. And he joins me now in the studio. Dr. Rose, welcome back to The Full Story.
Good to be here, Tom.
And I'll mention we're 6 feet away. We're still social distancing,
right.
So we're still in safe mode here in the studio. You've studied and written about Connecticut government extensively over the past 30 years. This book, this volume, seems a little bit different, both in size. It's slim, as I mentioned, and focused, too. You say that college students, in particular, really don't know much about local government.
That's exactly why I wrote this book.
Mm.
And you're correct. Almost all of my writing related to Connecticut politics has been statewide, you know, gubernatorial contests and so forth. But it became increasingly clear over time, as I have taught for many years, that our students, for the most part, really don't have a clue as far as what goes on at the absolute base level of government. And that's unfortunate because there's no question whatsoever that what goes on in a local government has so much direct impact on people's lives. And so I decided that it was time to write a small book, as you say, slender. It's a little over 100 pages. It's designed as really just a supplemental book in an American government course or a state and local politics class to introduce students to what's going on at the local level of government, which they have virtually no knowledge of. I mean, I've talked to students and I've asked them, you know, do you know who your mayor is? Do you know who your first selectman is? Do you know actually what type of government you have at the local level? And actually, not just our students, but students throughout the state, I'm sure, are unable to answer that question.
I must say, I wish I had this kind of a volume years ago as a young reporter covering local governments in towns around Connecticut. I would have had a very quick, effective idea of just what I was observing.
Right.
I didn't have to figure it out once I went in. It's the kind of book you slip these days in your backpack for a quick reference. So I think it works well that way. You mentioned over the years you noticed this lack of knowledge about local governments and students. Was this sort of a gradual, an evolution of change, or was it always that way? Do you recall a time where students were much more interested and had more knowledge about what was happening in their own towns?
No, I think it's been like that for a long time, a very long time. Mm. Students have had courses on American democracy. They've had courses on the U.S. Constitution. They're familiar with some of those principles. And they're even somewhat familiar with what's happening at the state level. But there has been, to my knowledge, and even when I was a young man and a student, nobody was really doing much in the area of local government. And it just seemed to me that there's this massive information gap that's out there as far as what's happening at the, like I said, the base level of our political system, which is so critical.
Do you think that's the case for most Americans, not just Connecticut residents or New York residents? We have many residents of New York listening to the program and to the station. Do you think most Americans really don't have much of an idea of what's going on in their town halls or city halls or buildings of local government?
Yeah, I would venture to say that it's nationwide. Mm. Maybe not in Texas so much, where I know they require a course not only on U.S. government but also Texas government. And perhaps they drop down to the county level there in Texas to do some discussions as well and some lectures. But I would venture to say that across the U.S., and I have taught actually in other states. You know, I taught in Kansas, Ohio, and Missouri. And I can tell you that nobody was doing anything on local government to speak of. Maybe some courses once in a while, you know, where there were some discussions and guest speakers and so forth, but real concentrated lectures and descriptions of how local government works, not much going on, no.
Is there a danger in that ignorance?
Oh, there's a tremendous danger in it, because really if our democracy, or our republic, I should say, if it's going to survive, you have to really know what's happening at the lowest level of government, because I've said for many years, of course, and I'm not just the only political science professor that would say that local government is in many ways the foundation of our republic, because it's upon the local governments that the state governments and ultimately the federal government rests. And I know that local governments don't have their own constitutions. They don't have, you know, legal sovereignty as states do. But nevertheless, if you don't have active, functional, local governments and an informed populace familiar with what's happening at the local level, then I'm afraid that the foundation starts to crumble somewhat, and I think it could affect what's happening at the state and federal level as well.
You say in the book, which reflects what you just said, really, I feel obligated to argue that local government is fundamentally indispensable to the freedom and liberties of the American people.
It truly is, and ultimately that's where it all begins, is at the local level of government. And individuals, when they become familiar with politics, should really, you know, gain that familiarity by observing a town council, observing who their local councilor is and what he or she, represents and the positions that he or she stands for. And I think that's what really contributes to an informed citizenry. So I think so much has to be done really at the local level in order for our republic to be sustained.
All politics is local.
All politics is
Tip
local.
O'Neill
that
who
was
said
old
that.
Tip O'Neill that said that. I know some political scientists now are suggesting that all politics is national, and that you know what's happening at the national level is working its way into state and local politics. But I, for one, still feel that that it really is the local level where politics begins.
Well, most people do seem to pay attention to the national government, sometimes state government. Is up there in the crosshairs,
yeah.
And people come out to vote for presidents on
they
a
do.
Fairly regular basis. Sometimes it's not a huge number, but it's certainly more significant than the numbers who seem to come out and vote for their local, even state rep, and certainly for their local boards of aldermen or councilmen or what have you. Whose fault is that?
Well, I think it really falls on the school systems, quite frankly. I think it all begins with education. You know, I'm an educator myself, and I believe that if we're going to have an informed citizenry, people participating in politics, they have to know what government is at all levels, national, state, and local. They have to know what the issues are. I would also put some of the blame on, unfortunately, I can't call it blame so much, but I would also say that in addition to the fact that we're not educating students like we should, newspapers these days, as I mentioned in one of the chapters of the book, really are folding, and they're not informing the public about what's going on at the local level. And that, to me, is also really, really distressing to see that. So I'd say if we want to say why this has happened, I'd say that it's a fault of our educational systems by not focusing more on the local level of the polity, and I would also say that the media and newspapers in particular are not informing the public as they should.
I guess back in the day that would be called a civics class when it comes to the gap in education.
Yeah, you know, I was very involved several years ago here in Connecticut in mandating a civics course. In fact, it was actually my lecture to the League of Women Voters up in Hartford that prompted them to say, well, maybe we should have a required course on, as you say, civics here in Connecticut. And so I was very happy that I participated in that. And then a law was passed mandating a civics course. But, you know, what is it really? It's really more of a course on national government. Again, it's doing very little as far as state and local are concerned.
I'm speaking with Professor Gary Rose, political science professor Gary Rose of Sacred Heart University, about his new book. It's called New England Local Government, The Case of Connecticut. And we're talking about local government in Connecticut, its various forms. And I'd like to delve now into a bit of the history of Connecticut's government. It's important to understand that, I assume, in order to know how we got to where we are. First of all, why did colonists from Britain decide to come to this area in the 1630s, I guess via Massachusetts Bay Colony, but they wound up in Connecticut? Why did they spread out?
Yeah, there seems to be a couple of reasons. One was it had to do with the fertile land. And my own research found that a number of people, Hooker and his congregation and others, came here for the fact that the Connecticut River offered, you know, some economic opportunities, and that the land was really quite fertile here in Connecticut. So they migrated from, as you mentioned, from Massachusetts. I also discovered that Puritans came to Connecticut largely for religious reasons, too. Mm-hmm. People had congregations, and they wanted to have some independence, and they came from Massachusetts and from Boston, that area, coming down here in order to really set up their congregations and to have some religious freedom, too. So I think it was a combination, from what I could tell, that much of it had to do with simply agricultural opportunities as well as religious opportunities.
And then, as you point out, by twos and threes, people spread out more. Little independent colonies were settled by people looking for what? More of the same?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. You know, we talk about how there was Connecticut Colony, but there was also, for a while, there was Saybrook Colony, and then there was New Haven Colony, and then it was all, you know, ultimately they were all absorbed into the larger Connecticut Colony. But, yeah, we had all these little colonies, actually, in this little area that we live in today, Connecticut, and we had actually three separate colonies functioning at one time. And then finally, like I said, they all became, you know, amalgamated really into one larger colony. And then we had all these little towns showing up, and then there were towns that would spring out from those existing towns. And as I mentioned in the book, you know, I cite one of the researchers on the development of towns, that there were clusters of towns that started, and then there was a proliferation that would come from those clusters. And the one thing I could, you know, ascertain here through my own research was that everything was kind of random in a way, the way a lot of these towns started. You know, there was no real specific plan, in that you had deals that were cut with landowners, and people were land speculators, and eventually it just kind of evolved and developed into what we have today, 169 little towns in this little state.
And as you point out as well, it's not like the area was empty. It was not unpopulated at the time. The Pequot people lived here, and tensions eventually grew, and that finally exploded into a war.
Well, there was, the Pequot War. It was really a devastating war for the Pequots. And, you know, I'm not an expert on the Pequot War, but there were a lot of problems that the colonists were having with the Pequots. And of course, they found the Pequots to be really quite a menace to their own existence. But, you know, we mentioned the Puritan colonists, but also what I discovered from writing this book, too, is that the Dutch were actually here as well, you know, and they, too, were having some issues with the Pequots and or Indian tribes. And so there was this really attempt to really, if you will, deal with the Pequots in a most forceful way. And what was very interesting is not only did the colonists unite to fight the Pequots, but there were some existing Indian tribes here who didn't like the Pequots either. And they actually collaborated with the colonists in order to wage war against them.
So eventually, all of these little fiefdoms, as you pointed out, were absorbed into what became Connecticut Colony. Mm-hmm. Yet they still retained local control of what happened within their borders. They were still individual in that way?
Yeah, they were individual. There has been in Connecticut this long tradition of small communities that, and I think that shows in the fact that we have 169 towns in this state right now, and it's been that way for a long time. And so, sure, we did have a general court, which was up in Hartford, and that was the main center of the colony, and then which eventually became the state, and it still is. But nevertheless, there has always been this long history of commitment to local government, and I don't want to use the word sovereignty, that's a little too strong, but there is this sense that people like their little communities, and they don't necessarily like to be governed from a general court, or if you will, which eventually became a general assembly up in Hartford. And so, we had the larger Connecticut colony. It did absorb the other colonies, and it did govern the colony. But at the same time, there was still a very strong sense of decentralization in this colony and our state.
Do you tie this attachment to, as we've come to call it, home rule, I guess, to the way the colonies were developed, to the way the state developed over the years? It's as you point out, there were only two states in the country. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
With no real county governments.
County government, right.
Connecticut and Rhode Island, I believe the other one was.
That's right.
Connecticut and Rhode Island, of course, neighbors. Is there something about the way these states developed that led to this really, really strong attachment to home rule?
Yeah, I think it did have to do with, really, it goes way back when we first started. Perhaps it has something to do with the whole Puritan, culture that started in this colony, is that the Puritans like to have their own communities and their own churches and their own ministers. And I think it really did lend itself to a lot of local pride, and they didn't like to have a larger government really controlling them. And we even did experiment once with county government, and it proved to be very unsuccessful. It was in the late 50s, early 60s. We tried to have county government, didn't work in Connecticut, and because again the pull of towns was too strong.
Interesting the timing, because you point out that the concepts of home rule became more than a concept in 1965. It was codified into state law, this home rule idea. Why did it take so long to recognize it legally? It was happening anyway for hundreds of years.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned in the book, there were some historical attempts to create it. And we did have some laws that they tried to pass to give communities home rule. It's a good question why it took so long. I just think that it became just a political issue, that maybe some of the legislators up in Hartford just weren't completely confident or they weren't completely willing at this point to turn, so much power over to local communities. And so it's got a long story behind it. But at the same time, eventually it came to fruition when it came time to write a new constitution, and they added it to the 1965 constitution. I just think it had to do with some lawmakers and governors, too, that were unwilling to relinquish so much authority to local communities.
You say at times, a quote, at times it seems as if there are 169 separate nations coexisting within the borders
yeah.
of Connecticut.
Yeah, right.
And then there are three basic forms of government that you describe in those municipalities. Mm. And then what seems like an infinite number of variations among those three. Is this organized chaos or really well-oiled machines? What do we have here? How in the world does it work?
Well, it's one of the beauties of local government, I think, and home rule, is that, when we passed that constitution, we added the home rule provision to it. It's up to the individuals of the town how they want to govern themselves. And, you have to go through a pretty elaborate procedure to do that. And in the end, the state can nullify it, I should point out, because home rule does not mean that a town has total constitutional sovereignty. That's not the case. But at the same time, it is interesting. You can go from just one town to the next, and you find actually a dramatically different way in which they govern themselves.
Well, without getting too deep in the weeds, what are the three forms, and does one work better than the other?
Well, you know, I think people could debate that. You know, the three forms, largely the three basic forms, are the mayor form. That's a pretty traditional way where you have a strong mayor, but at the same time, a very active and pretty powerful council. That's the mayor council form. You have checks and balances there. Another model is which you find in a lot of small towns, which really, I think, in many ways personifies what New England government is supposed to be, and that is, you know, a board of selectmen with a town meeting. And the town meetings themselves, people within the towns actually get together and vote on issues. Unfortunately, with a lot of those town meetings, turnout in the town meeting is very low, and there are some communities that have actually done away with the town meeting because hardly anybody's showing up. But we still have them, as I show in the book, that that we have in a lot of communities here in Connecticut, town meetings. And even though maybe you only have, you know, 25% of the voters actually showing up, they are making decisions on budgets and so forth. Then you have really the other model, which is pretty common in the middle-class communities, not just in Connecticut, but across the country. And it was all part of a reform effort to make a government less political and more administrative. And that, of course, is the town manager council form of government. And there, the town council does have a ceremonial mayor, but the person really doesn't have any extra power. But the town council functions in conjunction with a town administrator, who we call the town manager. And the town manager has a lot of financial responsibility. He reports to the council. But at the same time, the councilors have to run for office, of course, but at the same time, it's not a, you don't have that one central figure like you do with a mayor or like a first selectman. It's really more of it's supposed to be an efficient, less political form of government. And my own town, for example, went from having the board of selectmen with a town meeting to a town manager form of government. It seems to have taken some of the politics, and I should say some of the fun, out of government as well. And actually, some say that the town manager council form of government is kind of a boring form of government. But I'm not so sure I'm crazy about that.
I'm speaking with political science professor Gary Rose of Sacred Heart University in Fairfield about a new book he's written. It's called New England Local Government, The Case of Connecticut. And we're talking about some of the specifics of how the various towns and cities, 169 strong, get things done when it comes to government. This vast array of local governments have held strong even as the population has grown more diverse, at least in raw numbers. You point out that most of the towns are rather small with, quote, very white populations, and the greater diversity being in the larger cities. Does the home rule concept, do you think, prevents or discourage integration?
That's an outstanding question, Tom, and the answer to that is yes, it does. Mm. We have a very, as I note in the book, it's a very segregated state. And even when we have Governor Lamont at one time was talking about regional schools. And I know there's some regionalization going on up in Litchfield County these days, but nevertheless, there's a lot of resistance, you know, to blending towns and working with towns. And so some of that has to do, obviously, with this protectionism that I've been talking about, this pride that people have in their communities. They don't want to give up a lot of what – they don't want to give up the authority they have. It lends itself to a lot of little communities that are very protective, you know, of their way of life, and not a lot of connections with urban areas. Sure.
I'm wondering how the populations, the people living in communities in the larger cities, how they view this concept of home rule. I don't know that you got into that in the book, but perhaps through your research. Mm-hmm. I wondered if you had run across any thoughts or feedback from people in communities in the cities about this idea of home rule and what could be preventing the ability of folks to live pretty much wherever they want.
Yeah, well, you know, from what I can determine, there are a number of urban leaders, and in particular, persons of color, in several of our urban communities in Connecticut, who really have some issues with the home rule provisions that are taking that are in place here in Connecticut, and see the home rule provision in the Constitution and this notion of, you know, small communities that are very protective of themselves as preventing their movement into other parts of Connecticut, and housing issues and enjoying the fruits of really better education systems and so forth. And so it seems as if this whole home rule issue that I know you're probing here is in many ways an urban versus suburban rural issue. And I think it's one of the beauties of Connecticut, the fact that we do have communities that can govern themselves. But you're absolutely right that it also, one of the consequences of home rule is that we have a state that is very divided in terms of communities, and people really just don't want, you know, to give up what they don't want to give up their education system, their housing policies, their zoning policies, and they just want to live their own lives. A lot of people, they don't want it connected to the larger urban, you know, parts of our state.
As someone who's studied extensively and written extensively about Connecticut government, do you think the home rule with the various types of local governments is something that could adapt to changes that would allow for instance, the processes that would lead to integration without fundamentally changing how the home rule government works?
No, I don't think so. I think that the policies that you're suggesting here, integration, school integration, housing integration, and so forth, home rule is not going to facilitate that. What will, of course, is, of course, court rulings, and that's how it's going to happen. I don't foresee the you know, local selectmen, town councils, even mayors in other communities outside of the urban area really doing much in the way to facilitate that. I think it's going to have to come from, of course, legal decisions.
Again, you had described the state as 169 separate nations coexisting within the borders of Connecticut. Does that approach, let's talk about money for just money for a moment. Does that affect the ability of the towns and cities to be efficient with their money? You mentioned regionalization before. It does seem like that approach, when it comes to some municipal operations, would save money. But then there's home rule.
Yeah, there are those who suggest that if we went to county government, that we would probably be able to lower taxes here in Connecticut. I don't know if that's absolutely correct, but at the same time, I would still suggest, though, that, you know, people that live in communities like to have some control over their budgets, and so to relinquish that to larger, you know, entities like county government and so forth, I think there would be just too much resistance for that. And so the home rule is consistent with having some control over taxes and mill rates and so forth. And you know, I mean, I'm a strong supporter, I will say, of home rule. I am. I like the fact that a community can have its own government and basically decide how much revenue it should have. And so while would it save money? Maybe. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I've heard some suggest that, but I'm not 100% convinced of it.
There is some regionalization that does go on, right, in terms of schools. Oh, there
yeah.
are regional
oh, yeah.
high schools and
yeah,
middle
sure.
schools where small communities come together and share the cost of education, right?
They do. Yeah, yeah, sure. We do have some regional schools. And like I said, I believe there's one happening right now. They're under review up in Litchfield County. There's talk of regionalization of some schools. And I often hear that money, you know, could be saved by that. Maybe so, Tom. You know, it's very possible. But again, you are relinquishing some of your own authority when you do that. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's a lot of resistance to it.
In a chapter about innovations and policies, you do mention an infrastructure program, I believe, in Danbury with the sewer system that would actually
reach across
not only a town border but a state border.
I know.
to cooperate. That seems pretty radical for a Connecticut town.
Yeah, the sewer system.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Interestingly enough, the mayor is, of course, now with the Lamont administration, mm-hmm. is very much behind that. But at the same time, I found that fascinating. The fact that Danbury would reach over into New York there to hook up sewers, and apparently it would save money. And so back to your other question about regionalization, I don't know if that's really an example of real regionalization, but interstate cooperation, very interesting that there has been that proposal. Where exactly that stands right now, I'm not exactly sure. I was talking to a reporter not long ago. He says it's still on the books and it's still moving that way. But I don't think that it has really taken off yet.
We talked a bit about local newspapers, local press covering what's happening in local government, watchdogs, so to speak. And you do talk about that in your book as well.
Sure.
And there's been pretty much a decline in the number of newspapers, radio stations as well, with local news departments that would go to the town meeting, would go to the representative town meeting or the city council meeting and cover the nitty-gritty of how a town works. Is there a danger of losing that kind of information as far as local residents are concerned?
There's a tremendous danger here, Tom. And I did interview, as you know from reading the book, I interviewed a reporter, too, who actually was one of my former students. It's easy to interview a former student. And described it as news deserts. I'm sure you've heard that term. Mm. And that we now have a lot of communities where there is just really minimal coverage as far as what's happening in their community because the local newspaper is gone. And so you do have the larger newspapers that maybe have a segment. You know, they might assign a reporter once in a while to cover a town council meeting or a town meeting or whatever. But at the same time, the real substance and depth of the reporting, it really has declined. And so, I'm completely with you to express concern that as our newspapers have declined here in Connecticut, the number of newspapers fewer and fewer of them, they're going out of business. And those that do exist are being owned by corporations, too, large corporations. You have to wonder what's happening really to the real, as I mentioned, you know, to use the term that's very common, watchdog role of newspapers, because how else are we going to inform people? I guess maybe you have to go on Patch, you know. You get
the online news,
maybe you can get information from them. But I still think that the printed copy of a local newspaper is where historically we have gotten really by far the most substance and coverage of what happens in local government. And I don't for one believe that the digital coverage that's going on now, you know, various reporters, many of them are freelance reporters too, it serves the same purpose.
Do you think that could be one of the reasons why there's been, for example, a decline in the participation at town meetings when it comes to voting on, you know, important issues that could change policies or spend thousands or millions of dollars?
Oh, it's very perceptive, that point you just made. Sure, as people become less informed, then of course they may not even know what issues are germane to their community. And less motivation, you know, for showing up at a town meeting because maybe they are unaware of what's happening. And so I find it to be extremely troubling that so many newspapers have gone out of business and that we have to rely on, again, the more regional papers and the digital sources now to learn about politics. I'm not saying they're doing a terrible job, but you can't say that what's happening now is comparable to really those strong traditional local papers that we used to have, and the owners and with their reporters. They always knew who they were too, and they were always good, and always going to the meetings and covering events. And sure, I think you have a real problem there. That as the newspapers go down, not surprisingly, I think there's a correlation there with less participation and involvement in local government.
And in a more spectacular way, maybe you could talk about some of the very high-profile scandals that were exposed through watchdogs, through newspapers, digging up information, reaching back, I guess, to the 30s and 40s.
The Hayes Ring.
Yeah,
and interestingly enough, three of the scandals emanated from Waterbury.
We're not saying anything.
I won't say that. Okay. Right. But again, let's face it. I mean, there is scandalous activity that takes place in government. And how do you expose the scandalous activity? You do so through aggressive reporting. And when you start laying reporters off, as many have been recently, then we're going to have people in government who are not being watched as carefully. And so we've had some really high-profile scandals in the past, which I mention in the book. I guess the question becomes, what scandalous activity is taking place that's not being watched?
Mm.
Yeah.
Are local political parties organized differently in Connecticut? Do they approach things differently, given the diverse approaches to government that we have in Connecticut?
Well, when you go into other states, what you find is a state central committee, as we have in Connecticut, a state central committee. But then you have those county governments, and you have county commissioners, and you have county party leaders. And they have a lot of control, the county persons. They have a lot of control over state legislators. Even congressional persons have to deal with these county party chairs. We don't have that in Connecticut. The line now in the line of authority is from the local party organization to the state central committee. You don't have that county, chairperson hovering in between and controlling local government and controlling what's happening, say, in state legislative and congressional elections. And so, the party system is very different in Connecticut. We have 169 little party organizations, and then we have the state central committee. And you don't have the real unifying control that a county system provides. It's very different.
Given all the diversity in terms of approaches to government in Connecticut. Mm. Where is the real seat of power in local government?
In local government, mm-hmm. Where is it?
Yeah.
Well,
who has it?
Yeah. Well, I would like to say it's the people. I would like to say that it's the voters in a town, and I still believe that. And for me to say otherwise, I think would be inaccurate. Let's face it. Regardless of what kind of model we're talking about here. If you have a board of selectmen, it's the people that vote for the board of selectmen. That's power. If you have a mayor council, the people do vote for that, although I know that some mayors have sometimes been elected under nefarious, under a cloud of controversy, I should say. Mm-hmm. Even in the town manager system, the people don't pick the town manager, but they do select the town council. And the council picks the manager. So I would say, when you get into power, I still believe that it's the people that have the power, irrespective of the model that they choose.
If someone wants to become involved in local government, mm-hmm. even though this sounds rather complicated, but if somebody wants to move forward and become involved in their local Connecticut city or town, what's the best route to take, do you think?
I get asked that question a lot from students. How do I get involved? Mm. And the answer is through your political party. And that's the one thing, we didn't talk too much about that, but the local parties are, as I mentioned in the book, gatekeepers. And if you want to be a candidate, you got to go through the local party organization. And if you want to get involved in politics, and if you want to get appointed to a board, if you want to become a candidate for like the PZC or the Board of Education or, you know, get on Wetlands Commission or something like that. You got to do it through the party. And so remaining outside the party system is not the answer to involvement. It's you got to register with the party and you got to start making connection. You got to go to your town. You got to go to the party meetings, you know, when they have their caucuses and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I tell students that often, look, if you really want to become a political activist, do so through the party. And in Connecticut, you're not going to really get the first base if you're not in the party. So that's the answer to that.
What would you like readers to take away from this book?
That local government is really central to our existence as free people. I think that's the larger position here that I'm taking in this book, and that our republic depends on very vibrant, strong, healthy local governments with people involved. You already mentioned the power issue. And if our local governments aren't functioning well, if the people have no knowledge of local government, then I think the foundation upon which our larger republic rests can crack, and I think that it can lend itself to other problems. So if we don't have those vibrant local governments to start with, then watch out for the rest of the political system that we live under.
Dr. Rose, thank you so much for your time today and your insights about Connecticut's local government. We appreciate it.
Oh, sure, Tom. It's a real pleasure.
Political science professor Gary Rose is the chair of the Department of Government, Politics, and Global Studies at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. And his latest book is called New England Local Government, The Case of Connecticut. After my interview with Dr. Rose, he added that Connecticut did have county government prior to the 1950s, although it wasn't county government in the true sense of the term, nor how other states actually conduct county government. It was more administrative than governmental, and what was left of county government in the 1950s was finally abolished in 1960. WSHU's senior political reporter Ebong Udama got an insider's look at redistricting from former U.S. Congressman Steve Israel. He got caught up in the upheaval that the process caused when the lines for his district on Long Island were redrawn in 2012. Ebong, hello.
Hello, Tom.
Would you tell us a bit more about what happened to Steve Israel's district?
Well, on the map, it now looks like a claw hugging both sides of Long Island Sound. There are parts of it that are in Suffolk County through Nassau County, Queens County, and then across the water on parts of the Bronx and Westchester. That's what the new New York 3rd Congressional District looks like. This is Congressman Israel says, whoever represents this district now is going to need either a boat or a bridge.
And you spoke with the former congressman a few weeks back about the problem with redistricting. What was his take on the process?
Well, as you know, redistricting is in the U.S. Constitution. It makes sure that each House district represents roughly an equal number of voters. And Congressman Israel says the problem is that politicians have hijacked the process in most states. Here's his take.
Well, originally, the constitutional intent behind redistricting was that we took a census every 10 years and had to make sure that every member of Congress represented roughly the same number of people. And that makes sense. But redistricting has become a political weapon where Sharpies are used to defeat members of political parties. Districts are drawn to by politicians to protect politicians. And the result of that is that when you have districts that are drawn redder to protect Republicans or bluer to protect Democrats, the center evaporates, the center vanishes, and bipartisanship is lost because there's no incentive for members in redder and bluer districts to cooperate anymore.
Did he talk at all about how different states handle the process? Because it can vary from state to state, right?
Yes, you know, Tom, elections are a local affair, so states have different approaches. Here's what Steve Israel had to say.
There are a variety of different ways that states can redistrict. The conventional way, and I have to say I'm an offender because when I chaired the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, I was deeply involved in ensuring that we had as many Democrats in Congress as possible. The conventional way is to literally use a computer and a magic marker and draw lines in and out to ensure that you have, in the case of Democrats, as many Democratic voters as you can, in the case of Republicans, as many Republican voters. This is why some of these districts look preposterous. They weave in and out, they cut around certain enclaves of populations, they go far and wide, and that is why it's called gerrymandering. There are other ways, more sensible ways, and the good news is that more states have decided to take the partisanship out of the drawing of maps, and they rely on independent nonpartisan commissions, or they apply fair legal standards that can be upheld by a court to ensure that districts are being drawn in accordance with the original constitutional intent, which is to establish the populations for each congressional district, rather than a partisan intent to protect incumbents.
You asked former Congressman Israel, too, specifically about California. Why did you bring that up?
Well, really, I did that because since 2010, California has had an independent citizens redistricting commission to draw up its congressional district maps. Israel believes that's the way to go.
Did he have anything to say about the nonpartisan commission that New York set up to draw the lines?
He says the New York Commission didn't work out because New York politicians didn't allow it to happen. Here's what he said.
It was programmed to fail, quite honestly. They couldn't get consensus on this bipartisan commission. No surprise there. And so as a matter of law, the process was returned to the state legislature and the governor, and they had control. Now, in fairness to the governor of New York and the state legislature, you have red states that are using, you know, Sharpies and magic markers as swords to slay Democrats with such a small margin in the Democratic majority in the House. It should be no surprise that in New York they drew districts that would help ensure the return of Democrats to the majority in Washington.
Now, Congressman Israel, a while back, wrote an article for The Hill. That's a news website that covers Washington, D.C. And it was about how the number of swing congressional seats in the country have really shrunk, drastically shrunk over the years. And you asked him to elaborate on that, right?
Yes, I did. And you know, he used to head the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. So he had a front row seat on all of this. Mm. And he's observed it for quite a few years. Here's what he had to say.
I saw this for myself over the course of 16 years. When I was elected to the House of Representatives in 2000, there were 150 purple districts, fairly competitive, moderate districts. When I became chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee in 2011, it had shrunk to about 75, largely as a result of redistricting, making districts more red or more blue. When I left Congress, and shortly thereafter, it had shrunk to, believe it or not, 16 out of 435 districts in the United States Congress, 16 could be considered pure swing districts. And I define that as 9 districts with a Democratic member of Congress that voted for Donald Trump, and 7 districts with a Republican member of Congress that voted for Joe Biden. Because of partisan redistricting, everything was all of these other districts were made to empower the base of both parties.
Is there a fix for this problem? Did he offer a solution?
Actually, he did, but it would probably be quite controversial because, as you know, it would override local control if you had nationalized elections, and we don't have that in this country. But here's what Israel had to say.
I think there is one simple solution, and that is to have a national redistricting commission that is charged with drawing lines to reflect contiguity fairness, to ensure that members of Congress are representing roughly the same number of constituents, and take the partisan agenda and the partisan intent out of the process.
How does that conflict with states' rights?
Well, many states are doing that on their own. You know, the federal government has not shown much willingness to pursue an independent or to enact an independent redistricting commission, although legislation to that effect did pass the House of Representatives under Speaker Nancy Pelosi. It had no chance in the Senate. So because of the reticence of members of Congress to support fairer, less partisan, more competitive redistricting, states have decided to do that. Now, either we're going to have 50 states ultimately that play by those rules, or have a national standard. The current scenario is just not sustainable for democracy. You have members of Congress who wake up in the morning not worrying about losing in a general election, but worrying about losing in a primary because their districts have become so Republican or so Democratic, which is why the Congress is as polarized as it is now. That's just not sustainable for democracy.
But I wonder if the idea of a federal group overseeing the process is really viable.
That's hard to see anytime soon. You have to consider how polarized national politics is at the moment.
And Israel blames gerrymandering for the widening divide between the left and the right, correct?
Yes, he does. And this is what he told me.
Well, right now we're looking at a terrible imbalance where some states are drawing fair districts and other states are drawing intensely partisan districts. That needs to be reconciled over the long term. In the absence of federal action, we're going to have to rely on pressuring states, more states, to seek more balanced representation. But, you know, the stakes are very high. People tend to yawn at this issue of, you know, whether we're going to reform redistricting. But I'll tell you what, I saw it firsthand. Do you know why Congress has lost any sense of bipartisanship? Because there are only a handful of bipartisan districts left. Every other district forces the incumbents to move further to the left and further to the right. And it's all the result of redistricting.
Ebong, thank you for bringing us this insider's look at the process, if we can call it that, of redistricting.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. Anytime.
Ebong Udama is WSHU's senior political reporter, and he was speaking with former U.S. Congressman Steve Israel of Long Island.
What's your local government like? Do you think home rule is the way to go? Let us know. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter at @FullStoryWSHU. And that's our program for today. Produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez, I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.